Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Curse Hall podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is a brash young man. He's a warrior, and he wants to marry a woman who, well, it's a little complicated.
Well, see, the way I was gonna go with it is I was gonna be like, Spencer, I have one request. I have to have your dog.
Leave Freya alone.
Give me Freya. I cannot live without Freya.
No.
I will fight you, sir.
Okay, then give me Pascal and Tiger.
No, I must also keep my cats and Freya.
Well, Freya won't like the cats because she's an attention hog.
Listen to my true heart.
Okay, whatever. Anyways, so this is the second to last episode ish. I have, there's a special episode around this re-release, but so this is the final pair are doing 1952/53. It's gonna be Ikaru, and this episode is the other film, the non-Kurosawa one, a little movie called Gate of Flesh. That's a different movie, Gate of Hell. For 1953, directed by, I practiced his name earlier today at work and I forgot it already.
Tienosuke Kinugasa.
Yes. And this,
we have somebody with us who should,
a special guest. We used to write, when I say we, I mean me and her, not Joel, for Semi Knife Fight, but that kind of died, unfortunately. But, and we kind of were in the same, like, writer circles-ish for a while, but her name is, do you say your last name? Do you mind, or?
Colleen Wangland.
Okay. Yeah, sure, kind of know that.
The Geisha of Gore.
Yeah, you had a great column.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, this is a specifically Kurosawa cast, but what's your history with Kurosawa? Like, do you remember when you first discovered his work, or has it always been like a part of, you know?
I think my first Kurosawa film was The Seven Samurai. I'd always been a fan of one of my favorite westerns was always The Magnificent Seven. And I think it was one night I was watching TCM and they were showing The Seven Samurai, and I had heard previously, oh, The Magnificent Seven was a remake of The Seven Samurai. So I said, let me check this out. And I completely fell in love with that film, and not just the directing, but the actors, like Toshirô Mifune. I absolutely adore him. So that kind of started me on the journey of Kurosawa. And I've seen Ron, and I've seen his version of Macbeth. Throne of Blood is an absolute favorite of mine.
Hmm. Yeah, Throne of Blood, interesting side fact about that. And at the time, in Japan, it was not well received, and people were kind of not excited about it.
I think it's a brilliant film, and the fact that Mifune did his own stunt work, and that they were real arrows being fired at him in those final scenes is just amazing.
Yeah, like that's a phenomenal film. It's just crazy. We talked about this in the Throne of Blood episode, but it's just crazy. Like, the reception in Japan was, meh, who cares? Kurosawa's old, basically. And,
I can't imagine that. He's such a brilliant filmmaker. I couldn't even imagine a film of his in Japan just being, like, meh.
He had an interesting relationship with, Japanese film, kind of in general. But this is not Throne of Blood. That episode had Andrew Schwartz and Justin Harrison on it. It's a fun time. Go listen to that one.
Boring.
Okay. But this episode is on Gate of Hell. This was either the first or one of the first films to win the Best Foreign Film Oscar at the Oscars in 54. Yeah, 54. That's when it came to America. Because it won Cannes the year before. So it was kind of like the big hot movie. And,
yeah.
I'll be honest, I think it's just a good movie. I said this beforehand, but I fell asleep twice watching this movie. And I had to read like a couple of reviews and stuff on it just to kind of
make yourself feel better.
Yes. I found other people had the same reaction. And some people really love this movie, and just like, well, I just want to understand where you're coming from.
No, I understand.
So I feel like I feel like this will be like the Kagamusha episode, where it's kind of like, yeah, it looks pretty, but you know.
I understand where you're coming from. It's like I said, I found it to be, I don't know, mediocre at best. I mean, it's a standard, you know, boy meets girl. Boy falls in love with girl. Girl's got somebody else, and I don't know. He loses his mind trying to get girl. I don't know. It's filmed well. I think the cinematography is great, especially early on in the film when you've got like the scenes of war going on because of this, you know, the whole the revolution and the uprising and trying to gain control, and you see the scenes of the samurai fighting, but then at the same time he cuts to scenes of like the ocean, just kind of, you know, the waves hitting the beach and like the flowers. So you have this kind of dual thing going on where you've got like chaos, but then the beauty in the chaos early on in the film. Mm-hmm. You know, and I liked that bit of it, but the rest of the film, I mean, it was filmed really well. The story itself, I found it to be just kind of like mediocre, like I said, you know.
Yeah, it's a interesting thing I found from it was Midnight Eye, which is a site that they don't post anything new anymore since I think 2015 they stopped, or 16, but they it's on Japanese film and just kind of all like every aspect of Japanese film, like they do like the like Pinku exploitation, and then like the review of Gate of Hell, there's stuff on Hideo Gosha, and they're like they cover everything. And the Gate of Hell article is by Jasper Sharp, who's written a couple books on Japanese film, and his interpretation is pretty much ours, which is you know, it's good and all, just kind of yeah. And the thing, interesting part thing of that is in Japan at the time, this did not make a whole lot of like top 10 lists at the end of the year. Like in Japan, this was received as it's all right, I guess. And outside Japan and Western Europe and America, they were like, holy shit, this is amazing. And so I don't know, like I think it was in the Sharp speculates maybe is this like not many people had seen a Japanese film. They'd seen Rashomon and maybe this.
Well, it says like, this was the first Japanese movie in color to be released outside of Japan, like commercially.
Yeah, so like...
So maybe that's what it was. Because I can't see people thinking Gate of Hell is on par with Rashomon.
Yeah, I'm thinking like, because Rashomon would have been like the big thing and a couple years before that. And then I think Mizoguchi was shown outside Japan, and he was appreciated. in France by Godard and all those guys who started French New Wave. Mm-hmm. Well, Agnes Varda kind of started it, but people don't give her much credit for like starting it. But
she was married to what's his name, wasn't she?
Jacques Demy.
Jacques Demy, yeah.
But he did musicals though, not like, I guess, I don't know enough about French New Wave to know if Jacques Demy falls into that tradition or not.
He was part of the New Wave.
I guess, like, I don't think of like Umbrella to Cherbourg as like New Wave because it's a musical, but
right,
I
right.
guess,
but it's a musical that's like taking Hollywood. I don't want to go into this. Anyways, it's doing the same thing that what's his name was doing.
Godard?
Shoot the piano player.
The guy from the Spielberg movie playing the NASA scientist or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And he was, you know, taking influences from Hitchcock and other things, like the things that he loved and putting them into his film. And then Demi was taking things from classic musicals and putting it in there. And neither of you asked me how I felt about this movie. I think you're just assuming that I agreed with you.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this movie?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I really liked it.
Oh,
I liked it a lot.
Okay.
I was not expecting what happened in this story. And I have to say, we've watched a lot of Japanese movies, and this is the first time I've actually been surprised by this kind of thing. Because normally, I think in these movies, the woman is the, like, turned into the bad thing, you know, or she's the really weak-willed one and stuff like that. And, like, the actress, sure, she was doing the Japanese woman who's upset and shows a lot of emotion compared to the movie.
And she was in Rashomon as well.
One thing that I'm, like, used to these people doing is hiding all these facts from him, you know, like her husband and her husband being, like, a brute, you know, angry person. This is, like, the first time I've ever seen one of these where the guy who's, like, hardcore pursuing her is just an evil prick, and, like, the wife and the husband are actually very happy.
Yes.
Her husband isn't like, well, I'll take care of him. He's like, oh, it's going to be okay. Don't even worry.
Yeah. Like the horse race.
Yeah. And a lot of this came off as very Hollywood. Like, there, you know, the musical cues when they were revealing characters for the first time and beautiful colors. And, it felt kind of like a Hollywood movie with a little bit more blood than they would have allowed.
Yeah. Only a little bit, though.
Yeah, there's barely any, like, actual blood violence in this. You know.
Well.
So what I'm saying is you guys are both wrong, and I'm right.
Okay. Well, I'm sure former guests Ryan and Lauren like this movie and can convince us that we're both, at least convince me that I'm wrong.
Jeez, I don't even know. Yeah, I can't tell you what they would think. It go either way with them.
I don't think
I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely not wrong. I see what both of you are talking about. For some reason, it just charmed me.
It just my whole thing was spoilers aside. I mean, when it gets to the end, the husband is almost. It's like he blames her for her death. You know, it's like. He's like, oh, well, I can't believe she did this to me. And I'm just sitting there going, are you for real? Like,
I mean, that's typical Japanese man behavior,
really. No, I know. It's just, but that part of it kind of, like, she pretty much was kind of on her own. And I know the husband was telling her, you know, you can trust me and whatever, like, through the story. And then she reaches this point and this is what I have to do. And it was pretty noble of her to do what she did. And then her husband's just like, I can't believe she did this to me. Yeah. And you're like,
what am I supposed to do now? Jeez.
It's like, wait a minute. But she saved your freaking life. She died for you. That's how much she loved you. And you can't even give her that. So that annoyed me.
Like, I believe he cares for his wife, but at the same time, you don't get the feeling he necessarily believes her. And, like, there's this constant thing of she's trying to tell him, like, this will end badly, and he keeps him like, nah, no, it won't. It's fine. And it's kind of like he's trying to be reassuring, but he just doesn't believe her.
I think that, like, her husband and Marito, which means little Mo, is from a different world. No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, they're from different worlds. So Wataru, her husband, is like, well, we'll handle this like gentlemen. You know, we're both samurai now, and this is, you know, it's really silly that this is going on, but we don't have to worry about it. And she's like, no, you don't understand. He's got the crazy eyes. He's going crazy. Like, oh, but we both have attended court. And it's like, no, he's gangster.
Yeah, like,
well, he also should have kind of known that Morito had crazy eyes at the dinner after the games. Yeah. When, you know, he, like, literally, like, threw his food and was just like, no, you know, I don't care that, you know, she's your wife, I want her, whatever. And the husband I find is too calm. But I also find they're really, I mean, overall, I don't feel that there was much character development in this film, at least as far as the husband goes. I feel like they just kind of, you know, all right, like he's the husband, and he's just kind of being like a good guy and whatever. You know, I find, you know, like her, we understood. Morito, we understood, but the husband, I just feel like his character was really underdeveloped for this whole story.
Yeah, I think that might be one of my main problems with this. He's just kind of so two-dimensional. Yes. Where, like, the other two are, like, it's supposed to be like a quote-unquote love triangle, but only two angles of it are developed, and other angles is kind of like, it's there,
it's not a love triangle. It's one solid line and then one squiggly line going from him and, like, slightly going past her and then kind of curving around back to her. It's like there's a solid relationship here, and Marito, he just can't get it through his thick skull.
Well, he's obsessed.
Oh, Joel. So it's been a while since I brought up a certain name. I found an old New York Times review. Do you know where I'm going with this?
No. Is it the personal section?
Sure. No. A film critic, Bosley Crowther.
Oh, yes.
That guy who kind of didn't like Kurosawa, but he reviewed most Kurosawa movies. He loves this movie.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Bosley Crowther, I think he's a foreign film reviewer for years at New York Times. But yeah, he loved this movie. Mm. Which, sure, I guess.
I mean, it's basic. Like, the whole movie is basic. It still does. I mean, I feel like that's being unfair. It's so technically well done, but it is like a machine. Like, we poured out this into a mold of, like, what's going to appeal to the mass audience and also have enough cultural relevancy that it is clearly a Japanese movie. And you came out with this, and I gotta say, I really liked it, but I don't think it's it doesn't compare to a Kurosawa movie. That's ridiculous.
No, but this is the same critic who said Seven Samurai is just a bland John Ford knockoff. So,
whoa. You know, he's dead now, so.
Yeah, and he also hated Godzilla, the original one.
Oh my goodness, who could hate Godzilla?
He just didn't like a lot of the big classic Japanese stuff, but he liked Bad Sleep Well. That's like the one Kurosawa he gave a pass. But yeah, I disagree with him on most of his reviews that I've brought up here.
So So do I.
But yeah, he's been dead for almost 40 years at this point, so who cares?
I mean, this is, like Joel was saying, this is kind of, it, Gate of Hell is kind of, it's like textbook. You know, it's almost like they said, all right, we'll make this Japanese film for Western film fans and see where it goes.
Exactly how it feels, yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's how it feels to me. It's like they said, we're not going to just make the standard Japanese film. We're going to do this specifically for a Western audience. And I think this is the result. And it is kind of, like I said, I've used the word mediocre. It is kind of bland. It's just a generic kind of story. And I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily recommend Gate of Hell to people who are, like, say, looking for, oh, what kind of Japanese films would you recommend? This is not one of them.
I think it'd be like an easy entry point. Like, if you were completely unfamiliar with, any Japanese history or movies, that it's like, hey, this is a nice, colorful movie. It's not too violent. You can easily follow the story. And it has a touch of the, like, historical thing going on in the background, which most of these movies do. It's like, well, this was going on, but anyways, here's our actual story.
Right, yeah.
So it's not that bad that way.
Okay, it's a good introduction, but I would still recommend something by either Kurosawa or even Ozu over Gate of Hell. Because I just, I think there are far more entertaining films out there.
Yeah. Also going back to Joel's point of being a good entry point, you could say Mizoguchi, but Mizoguchi is just can be just so unrelentingly bleak and depressing that, like, Mizoguchi.
I'm not giving somebody Mizoguchi as an entry point. What do you? I don't want them to be my friend, I guess. I'd
I won't give someone like the 4-hour 47 Ronin. It's a masterpiece, but.
Oh, that's a beautiful film.
Yeah, we did a great episode on it, but yeah, that's not one I could recommend to many people because of the runtime, mainly. But, I don't know. I guess we should go through the plot, even though it's not much of a plot necessarily. It's not very detailed.
I disagree.
Okay. Prove me wrong.
Okay.
So, the beginning of the movie, the Heijai Revolution is going on in the background, 1159, in the middle of nowhere. And we start off at, it seems like it must be wherever the emperor at the time was living. And his kinsmen are trying to get him out.
And his sister.
Mm-hmm. His sister, and they were talking about some other relative, but they're decide to separate the family and get them out as fast as they can while the rebels are overtaking everybody. And so they decide to have a decoy for the emperor's sister, and Lady Kessa volunteers to be this decoy. So she is assigned the samurai Morito Endo, and he guides her. Hold on a second.
Was that Sarah?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Tell her I say hi.
Spencer says hi.
Hi.
Anyways, he takes her to his house and, to hide her there. And while there is when he first observes how beautiful she actually is, because she's fainted because there was a confrontation between the rebels and the guards as they were trying to get her to safety. And while he's there, he's looking everywhere for his brother. Another man shows up and he's like, hey, is your brother here? Like, nah, man, he's at high school or something. I don't know. Like, well, tell him that the rebels are winning and it's great. He's like, wait, my brother's one of the rebels? And So there's a kind of a fight going on when his brother shows up, and he's like, "You fool, we dedicated ourselves to the emperor." And his brother's like, "Nah, dude. It's better being a rebel, trust me. I know what I'm doing." And while they're having this argument, Lady Kessa runs off, and Morito does not know what happens to her. So at this point, we see that the rebels have temporarily taken over a section of the land. They've beheaded somebody. Everybody's talking about this severed head of
A monk.
what was that?
A monk or someone?
Yeah, I was a
Oh
little
yeah, the emperor's like something, the monk.
right, high priest or something like that.
Yeah.
An advisor, I would assume.
Yeah.
And his head is hanging from the gate of hell, what he calls it. And I think it's just kind of a background thing because
Like,
almost.
we barely see the gate of hell. I think we see it like maybe four times at the most.
And this particular gate has a bunch of artwork that looks like it's done by Al Jaffe from Mad Magazine. But, it's like demons cooking people and stuff like that.
Actually like the artwork on the gate.
Oh, it's really cool. I'm not trying to put it down. It just looked comical to me.
There.
I guess, but I like the sudden shift from of this point from like the high class into like you see what the common folk look like, and they're still dressed in very vivid colors.
It's funny that everybody who's like, it's they're all hanging out outside the gate and stuff like that, but everybody's kind of like, another rebellion. Well, yeah, what are you gonna do? Don't worry, it'll go back to normal pretty soon. Always does. It's like they don't.
Well, I would think that's exactly how it went back then.
Exactly.
All the shoguns, fighting over territory and stuff.
Who was it? Slant, the movie website, they did a Blu-ray review, a review of the Blu-ray of this that came out about a year or two ago. And the reviewer, he absolutely loved this movie, and he pointed out that he brought, I have to find a passage, that the titular Gate of Hell basically represents, he connects this movie to like post-war Japan and his anxieties. I have to find that passage. He really brings that, brought something really. Okay, I found it. The titular gate is only glimpsed a few times, but the potentialities for damnation, doom, and violence it symbolizes hang over everyone throughout the film. A harbinger of destruction brought by a hypocritical and indifferent ruler that traffics in ideologies that would have to be and have yet to be entirely expunged. An intense exploration of post-war malaise. Gate of Hell, no doubt, meant quite a bit to the Japanese citizens who saw at the time of its release, but the clampdown anxiety it brilliantly conjures, the kind of anxiety that haunts newspapers every day, transcends this specificity of time and culture.
I mean, but there is doubt. You're
Yes.
saying that it wasn't very popular in Japan.
Well, like the critics.
That's an interesting take, though.
Yeah, I mean the critics in Japan were didn't like it very much, but I guess it must have made money. Yeah, but like, yeah, I didn't really think of it in terms of post-war Japan and the American occupation,
I didn't either.
which I get where they're coming from. But at the same time, I still kind of feel the same way about the movie.
Yeah, see, Lady Kessa is Japan.
Change what I think. Yes, Lady Kessa is Japan.
And Wataru is like the emperor, and the, you know, or not the emperor, whoever's running it. And
And
Morito is America.
it's the West.
Yeah.
Maybe.
That's
Yeah.
actually a very interesting way to look at it.
It's not as it's not as like clear cut as like Black River, where like Nagadai is like it would be like the West or Western influence versus the bookkeeper who's trying to just stay out of way and just let things happen. But yeah, I don't know, like the whole Gate of Hell thing representing this like the symbol of this destruction and violence that can happen at any moment. I don't know. I'm talking my ass now. I just never didn't think that much into it.
No, I didn't think of it either, but it is an interesting take.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. I feel like that's reading into it, which I mean, I guess any interpretation like is reading into it, but I wouldn't have read that into it, and I still kind of don't.
I can see just when talking about the Gate of Hell by itself, I can see that as, you know, being, you know, like kind of almost like showing, all right, this is what's gonna, you know, this is gonna end badly if you're talking about a gate of hell, you know?
Yeah,
And
and
that's
they hang the heads of the rebels, or I forgot, but they hang the heads of people that they think that they're beheaded on there. So it's
just
just
whoever is the in charge hangs the head of the other people, because he says like oh, the irony that high priest got his head up there, you know, last year he killed 177 people here and did the same thing, so he, I guess it's, you know,
yeah,
payback's a bitch or whatever.
right.
yeah.
The Japanese version of payback's a bitch.
Yeah, and like all the common people are just kind of like, it's here, but
Right.
it can happen anytime, and we're the fodder.
Yep.
Yeah, they're not fazed by any of it.
Yeah, their response is like when they see somebody coming towards it, they're like, okay, we better make ourselves scarce. They know it's like if we just hide where we live, it'll blow over and then things will be normal for a while. And yeah, it'll rise up again, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah, very, I
Yeah,
mean, especially in like knowing the context of how often they were at war with like the China and like Western powers before World War II even happened. It kind of makes sense that way too.
and like the graffiti on the gate of like demons and all the like the hellish imagery kind of ties into the whole like, yeah, the violence is just kind of a way
Normal.
of life.
Right.
Guys, this movie's really deep. No, okay.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I still like it. I understand.
Yeah,
Okay, so anyways, Morito survives his encounter with his brother and his goons, and he goes and meets up with this person, and the scene is basically to establish another character. He's like a he's not the emperor. He's like a general or something like that, right?
yes.
And he, you know, he's like, "Whoa, do we have news?" Of like, yes, they captured the sister and the other people. Like, oh no, what are we gonna do? Like, well, we don't have enough. We don't have any armor. It's not like we can go take the place back. And this other guy's just like, "Actually, sir, we have a bunch of armor, so that's what we're gonna do." He's like, "Oh, okay." And there's a scene where Morito realizes that one of
Oh,
these.
sorry. I have to mention something. So, Colleen, you mentioned the cinematography earlier. It was a Kohei Sugiyama. He was Mizoguchi's go-to cinematographer.
Ah, see? That's why the
Yes.
film looks so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely looks good. So Morito notices this one guy who, I mean, you see this guy. You didn't have to like pay attention to him getting off to go ride and warn somebody, but this guy looks crafty. And they end up having a very short battle. And this is probably the only real violence in the movie when he ends up cutting this guy down. And it's not really commented on. The next thing we see is that the Emperor's people have taken back the gate and, taken back the leadership, have killed a bunch of the rebels, including Marito's brother.
And this is just the first 20 minutes. And you think, and it's just a great bait and switch of like, oh, it's a war movie. Oh, no, it isn't.
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
You wish it was, though.
It could have been more. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't think about that. Like, it becomes way less involved after that point and more about this story of obsession. This, I mean, it feels influenced by Hollywood 50s stuff going on. So,
Kind of Douglas Sirk. It gets me like the melodrama that Douglas Sirk kind of is famous for.
yeah, well, one of those noir things like I became obsessed with this dame.
Oh,
She's
yeah.
gonna marry me, or I'm gonna shoot her.
Oh,
Didn't
yeah.
think of that angle either.
So, Morito, I feel silly saying his name.
It sounds like a dish at like a Mexican
That's what
restaurant.
I'm saying. It's Little Mo.
Well, you can say that 'cause you're Mexican.
Yeah, exactly. So he is there paying respect to the dead, and he spies Lady Kessa, and he's very, very happy to see that she has survived. And they have a little conversation, and there does seem to see almost be like a little bit of flirting between them, because he's just doe-eyed. He can't, so excited to see this beautiful woman once again. And she's, they kind of have a very short conversation. They don't have much to talk about, but her aunt comes and fills them in on a bunch of info, like, oh, we came from this village. Oh, famous for the chestnuts. Oh, yes, you should come over. It's like, you should come over to my place for dinner. Like, oh, actually, we have to return. She's a lady in waiting. It's like, oh, well, it was nice to see you. And that's it. That's the end of the movie. No. Next, we see a kind of reward ceremony where the general guy is handing out gifts to the people who fought against the rebellion. And when it comes to Morito's turn, he gets up there and he says, "You know what? Even though your brother was a traitor, I know that you fought valiantly, and you can have whatever you request." And Marito's like, well, there's this woman, Lady Kessa, and I want you to arrange a marriage between us. And everybody kind of laughs at him. Like, why are you laughing at him? He's just showing his emotions. And one of the guys is like, Lady Kessa's already married, dude. And this is the sign where things are not gonna go well.
That's a tough statement.
Yeah, I believe they start laughing at him.
Well, you do that.
Because he doesn't, even after finding out that she's married, he doesn't back down.
Yeah, it's an old school like movie romance where it's like, well, I'm in love, so I have to get the thing I love.
Right.
Now, the way I see this is where my expectations were led astray, because the way I assumed this was going to happen was it was going to turn out that Lady Kessa was like in a loveless marriage, and that, it's, but she felt obligated to her husband or something like that. And it was going to be this kind of tragedy thing that was going to happen where Morito was, pursuing her, and Wataru would be somebody that was awful and you didn't like. And that's just not what happens. When Lady Kessa returns home, we see her husband, Wataru, and his very, very large chin. He's a broad faced man. And they are incredibly, like, kind to each other. Like, to something, once again, I don't remember seeing this in a previous Japanese movie that takes place in, like, this kind of Edo period thing.
You know,
Where,
period was a couple centuries off.
I'm just making up words to sound smart, all right?
Okay.
The Heiju
It
period.
still works.
In this old
Yeah,
time.
Yeah, Ida was when like the Americans started to show up.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. In this pre-Edo.
Yes, it's pre-Edo. I don't know the name of this time period, but I know it's not Edo period.
No, you're right. I did not see. Obviously, I don't know. But you know, if I was having a casual conversation with somebody at a bar, I could just throw the word Edo out, and they'll be like, "Ooh, this guy's smart."
Yeah,
because nobody would know what you were talking about.
Exactly, except for that one guy who's like, "Wait a minute."
That's unless it was period. Me you were talking to in a bar, and I would call you on it.
Oh no. I'll be like, you'll be serving my family fries at the drive-thru. No, wait. So, anyway, yeah, the thing that he does that I don't remember seeing is like, will you share some sake with me later? And she's like, of course. And it's like, I can't remember a time when that, where it wasn't like, will you serve me sake later? It's like, no, we're going to share some with each other. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it just seemed like a warm, happy relationship. And it's like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
At that point. So, you know, word gets around that Morito did this and that, you know, it's embarrassing for Lady Kissa. Wataru just kind of laughs it off. Like, oh, you know, it's probably never going to happen again. Or no one's going to think of it again. So don't even worry about it. And the general guy decides to be a total prick and calls Lady Kessa to his, you know, his location. And she goes there. And I wonder if the actress actually did this, but whoever's mm-hmm. playing that instrument does an amazing job.
It looked like she was playing it herself.
Yeah. That was really cool, but you know, she thinks that, you know, he just wants her company to play this instrument. He's like, I'll be right back. And he gets up and he's like, Hey, Morito, your girlfriend's in there. Go in there and see what she says.
Yeah, that was kind of.
Yeah, the mean joke.
Yeah, that was kind of like a rat thing to do. Like, what the hell?
Okay. You say rad or rat?
Rat.
Rat. Okay.
As in the four-legged animal that we don't like in the New York City subways.
Or the band from the 80s.
Yes.
Going round and round.
Yeah.
But the actress, Machiko Kayo, she was in Rashomon Ugetsu, the Ozu's remake of his own movie, Floating Weeds. She's in the final Mizoguchi film, Street of Shame. She's in Face of Another, and she is still alive. She's 94.
Wow, God bless her.
Yeah, she's, I think, the last one of the last ones left that generation.
Wow.
Satsuko Hara was up there, but then she died a couple of years ago. But I think Machiko might be the last one.
Wow, that's amazing.
She played Princess Yang Kui Fei in that Mizoguchi movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She's been a lot of stuff from this era.
Yeah. So, anyways, it's embarrassing for her. Oh, she was in Odd Obsession, too. Did we watch that for the podcast, or I just watched that for fun?
You watched it for fun, and I missed it on Filmstruck. Yeah. I know Nakadai's in. Oh, sorry. So, you know I love me some Nakadai, and I missed it.
Yeah. And, you know, Morito in the room is trying to talk to her, but Lady Kessa just keeps playing her instrument. Like, she's purposely ignoring, like, I don't want to talk to you. I don't even want to look at you. He's like, I need to ask you a question. And he, like, puts his hand down, kind of wrecks her instrument, and finally mm-hmm. looks at him. And,
yeah, a koto.
Is that what that instrument is called?
Yeah, it has five strings.
Ooh.
It's a koto. And it's, I think it uses the pentatonic. Never mind. It's like about tuning it. It doesn't matter.
Panasonic?
It's music stuff.
Pentatonic.
It's a scale, and it kind of uses a scale to tune it. And that's a scale. Whenever you hear like the generic Chinese music, that's the pentatonic scale.
Miss Katonic. Okay, sorry.
Yes.
So this goes terrible. You know, Lady Kessa goes home and she tells Wataru what happened. And he's like, oh, that's weird. You're home now. Don't worry. I'm not going to let anyone take you. So, you know, he does his best at reassuring her.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, they're planning for this horse race that's going to be coming up, you know, a horse race for the gods. Mm-hmm. And Morito's like, you know what? I'm going to challenge this Wataru, who's won all the time. And I don't know what his thought. I guess he thinks if he beats him in the horse race, that'll win Lady Kessa's love. Even though I think she's made it very clear that she's not interested. So
yeah.
There's a cool horse race scene. And everyone thinks Wataru is going to win, but Morito pulls ahead and he does win.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time he looks like he's sweaty and angry.
He probably was.
And winning, of course, is no victory. Wataru goes and hangs out with his wife. And Morito's just like, ooh. So later when they are all having sake together, because it's supposed to be uniting. It's uniting the clans, uniting the samurai in this this sport. People are making fun of the whole situation, talking about, well, Wataru must have not whipped his horse enough, you know? It's like, he must have given it up on purpose. Lady Kessa probably told him it'll make it easier, you know, to have peace again. And Morito stands up and he's like, if you think that it was an unfair race, then we need to race again. In fact, let's not even bother racing. Let's just go out into the garden and stab each other with our swords. And, there's two ways to look at this. Wataru stands up, and he makes to leave. Now, this is, you know, either him walking away, like not even dignifying this situation where obviously Morito is drunk.
Mm-hmm.
But of course he gets called a coward. Or he is ignoring the obvious problem in his face. And it turns out, you know, by the end of the movie that he probably should have done something at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some boss man comes in and is like, Morito, man, we were supposed to be chilling out. Get the hell out of here. Get out.
Yeah. He said, like, no violence. It's just a place of peace.
It's a freaking rules. Morito, you know, as soon as he leaves, he goes straight to Wataru's house and is like, I need to see Lady Kessa. And Lady Kessa's lady-in-waiting is like, she's not here. She's at her aunt's house. And he's like, oh, I know where she lives. Like, oh, crap. So Morito goes to her aunt's house and he threatens her aunt until she sends a message saying that she's ill, that Morito is going to kill her unless she can get Lady Kessa to come over there so he can, quote-unquote, just talk to her. He's there waiting for her, and he says, as much as, like, if you don't agree to be with me, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill your husband. I'm going to kill your family, and I'm going to kill you. And at first, you know, she does not want anything to do with him. It's like, I'm definitely going to just start killing people, you know, so you better be, you know, let's do it right now or whatever. It's terrible.
Yeah, he means it.
Pretty bad. Well, yeah, he does.
Yeah. And she eventually, you know, after saying this, she says, okay, I agree. I'll be with you. I want you to leave my husband alone. He says, oh, I'm going to kill your husband. Like, well, I just said you're going to... Anyways, he thinks that he has to kill the husband.
Mm-hmm.
And so in another turn that I didn't necessarily know how it was going to go, she says, okay, I'll help you kill my husband. He's like, okay, put out his lantern at 9 p.m. and I'll go in there and kill him in his room. And she agrees to do this. So she goes home and she prepares sake for her husband, and she gives her lady-in-waiting a special gift and tells her, remember me by this. And her lady-in-waiting is so excited, she doesn't realize that this lady's probably going to die. And her husband's like, why are you so sad? This is such a nice night, you know? It's like, oh, no reason. And she says, well, why don't you sleep in my room tonight? So Wataru does. He lies down in her bed. And when he falls asleep, Lady Kesa goes into his room and disrobes and puts out the light and lies in the bed where he was supposed to be. Morito heads over there, sees that the light has been shut out, goes into the room, and without looking, just starts cutting away.
Yep.
And you get Lady Kesa killed quite suddenly, like, wow. And this asshole's like, I was such a fool.
Yeah.
It's too late.
I know. He just completely, all of a sudden, he's like, oh my god.
I didn't listen to your true heart.
Yeah.
And in the Bosley Crowther review, he keep in mind it's the 50s and you couldn't just like rewind it. He remembered this as she killed herself. Which I don't know. I think that's just him misremembering it.
Yeah, that's not what happened.
No. I mean, she knew what was going to happen to her, but okay. She did it to save her husband.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah. Technically she killed herself, but he was the one who killed her.
Yeah.
She just knew it was going to happen.
Who, right. Yeah. He wielded the sword.
Yes. Like, the phrasing he used it in the review is, I'm not sure if he meant it as if she knew that like what was going to happen, or if he misremembered as like she like took the blade herself.
I see.
Okay.
Yeah, the wording is kind of, yeah, I'm not sure what his intent was.
Yeah.
There.
Well, we know it's Morito's blade because he cuts through the covering of the bed and then cuts again, and then we hear her cry out. So,
mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh god, why did I do this? Where's the lord of this house, Wataru? And Wataru finally gets his ass up.
Well, Wataru is drinking, yes. So.
Yeah, he was inebriated and asleepriated.
Yeah. Yep.
And he gets up. And he rushes out there, and Morito is saying, I just killed your wife, and I need you to behead me now. There's no other way to go around this. Of course, Wataru immediately runs to go see Lady Kesa and see for himself that she is indeed dead. And, yeah, he starts going, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you trust me?
Right. Yep.
Oh, God, why? So he comes back out. Morito's ready to be beheaded. Wataru says, I'm not going, that wouldn't help the situation. If I killed you, she would still be dead.
Mm-hmm.
And Morito's like, well, are you a coward? Is like, Wataru's like, how is this going to help me? I have to live with what's happened here. I have to live with what you and she did. So he is definitely victim blaming.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Morito's like, oh, I get it. Yeah, you're right. I should live with all the terrible things I've done. So he cuts off his top knot, which I didn't realize until recently how big of a deal that was.
Really?
Yeah.
It took you this many movies to figure that out?
Well, no. I figured it out a couple months ago, but still.
That's okay. A very big deal for the samurai.
I mean, in the first episode we did, your father...
Yeah, he cuts off his top. Shaved
it. He shaved his head, and that was a big deal in the movie.
Well, we didn't talk like about it being a big deal.
It's a big deal in the context of the first scenes of Seven Samurai, where it's like, people like, oh, the samurai who shaved his head.
Yeah. Well, he also... When Morito cuts off the top knot, he also says he's going to start over and become a monk.
Yeah, which I didn't see that coming. I thought it'd be he'd kill himself,
Yeah, I
but
mean, he's got that little sword. It seemed like he was going to commit, seppuku.
that's what I thought he was going to do, that he was going to commit harakiri. But then it's no, I'm gonna become a monk and I'm just gonna live with this for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a cop out.
And that's the end. I think you see the Gate of Hell one
Yes.
last time.
Yeah, it
And
just kind of ends.
yeah, which I suspected when I watched it that was gonna be an ending, but then once it got to it just kind of felt like, oh, I thought there'd be more to this.
Yeah, I kind of felt that way too.
Yep.
That's
That's
like you were saying, it's a very like Hollywood friendly type of film. It's almost like the film was really made not for Japanese audiences, but specifically for Western audiences.
It was based off a play from, I have to look up when a play I delete I X out of the article at point where what play when a play is from, but it is based off of a famous play in Japan.
I was actually wondering if it was based off of some kind of folk tale, like really going back.
Yeah, I'm not seeing it on the Wikipedia article, but those aren't always the most
Yeah.
detailed things.
It was oh, it was
Jedagaki.
that's a subgenre of like the samurai films.
Cool.
And oh, in my notes, I found something I forgot. I wrote down because there was a ban on like samurai films and films like Japanese history
Right.
from 45 to 53, 54-ish.
Yeah.
And I feel like this helped break the barrier
Yeah.
because this is very American friendly in terms of like it's not about the it's not set in the present, so the American censor board won't have an issue with it. It's very Hollywood style, so like
That's
they can understand it.
exactly how I felt about it.
And then a cut to a year later, you get Seven Samurai, and so like the ban is basically dead because like this becomes such a hit like across comparatively of like to other Japanese films of this era, a hit overseas, and it's kind of like, oh, I guess we can just lift the ban now, and I feel like
I guess we should let them make art the way they want to
the
instead of
Right.
telling them what to do.
yeah, so I feel like this probably helped with getting Seven Samurai made. Okay, the
And they loved
play.
Seven Samurai so much they remade it.
Exactly. Well, the you might know this, but the Magnificent Seven was a American title from the American cut that is, I think, 2 hour 2.5 hours long. They cut
Yeah,
out almost an hour.
it's a pretty long film.
Yeah. I want to see that American cut. I just want to know what is removed. But
They cut out all the young girl thing.
I guess, I don't know.
Yeah, I
But like
imagine.
you cut out an hour of a movie. That movie is has so much stuff like what I don't know, think it could work with an hour missing, but okay, the play is from the 1100s. And it's based off a story. Well, it's based off actual history, which it says. But yeah, the play goes way back. So this was like a, it kind of like the we're doing Shakespeare adaptations. It's kind of like this old story everyone knows.
Sure, yeah.
Like I said, like a folk tale
Yeah.
passed down from generation to generation. Almost like a cautionary tale.
And they present it as such when they do what the Disney style, like the Japanese equivalent of the Disney style opening the
Yeah,
book, to tell the
the one
story,
you poo.
and then yeah,
yes,
they open the ornate
scrolls in
box.
yes, the scrolls in the
Yeah.
The 70s Winnie the Pooh thing.
Once upon a time,
Yep.
there was a bunch of people cutting off each other's heads.
Or the Ballad Buster Scruggs thing.
I haven't seen it yet. Don't spoil
Yeah.
it.
It's been on Netflix for a
Don't
couple of weeks.
spoil it.
But okay, the it does like the Disney book thing.
Spoiler.
Okay. Anyways, so I don't know if I could recommend this. If you're really interested in Japanese film, then yeah, I think it because of of its historical significance of being like one of the breakthrough films to like get more that like proved to like West that oh Japan's making it's making movies
Yeah,
there
like
there
introducing the West to Japanese film.
you know Rashomon did it better a few years before that but it's like well if you've seen like a bunch of Kurosawa, Ozu, Mizoguchi, Kiyoshita, all that stuff. Oh, as of this recording, tomorrow is Kiyoshita's birthday. He would have been, I think, over 100, but I
1,000
can't.
years old.
He died in 99. He's older than Kurosawa, but I can't remember how many years. Anyway, yeah, he would have been over 100 tomorrow. Anyway, about Kiyoshida, yeah, so this is, it just should be seen because, it's historically important, just like the for Japanese film, and it looks pretty,
I mean, I
and
don't.
it goes by,
Yeah.
Yeah.
it goes by a good pace.
I don't think it's a waste of time or anything like that, you know? You could
It's
do
not.
worse. You could watch a Michael Bay film, for God's sake.
Like you did on your birthday.
Yeah. Wait, what?
You saw the new Transformers in IMAX on your birthday.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
Oh, my
That
goodness.
movie sucked.
Yeah, you guys recommend it or it's kind of like, I don't know.
Meh. That's something I would necessarily recommend. There are other films I would recommend over this one, even for a beginner of Japanese film.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, I'm not, you don't have to run out and watch it or anything like that, but I do think it is a pretty softball Japanese colorful film, like. Just like a whole bunch of things that Hollywood was pumping out in the 40s and 50s. It's like some of the stories are repeated, and obviously the actors have their own shtick and everything like that. I still feel like a bunch of that stuff is worth watching. And
Yeah.
I think that this is, it's very pretty to look at, and the music I enjoyed, and I thought the acting was solid. And, put it on if you don't got anything else to do right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not. I didn't have the same reaction as I did to Kagemusha, which I have a similar feelings on,
Yeah, I think
but
we just had our expectations up so high about that.
yeah, and then it's almost 3 hours too, and it's kind of like, ugh,
Yeah, that's a long film.
this doesn't work. Some people love that movie. Some former guests love that movie, which more power to them. I don't understand what they see in Kagemusha, but
Why?
yeah, it's also a bunch of pretty colors and.
Yes, it's very colorful.
So, do you like Kagemusha, Colleen?
I actually do like Kagemusha. I mean,
More
it's not one of Kurosawa's better films, but it's entertaining enough. It's again, it's another film. I don't feel like I'm wasting my time when I watch it,
Right.
It's
Okay.
entertaining, it's colorful, it's but it's like that like if you like if I was speaking to somebody about Kurosawa who'd never seen a film by him, that's not a film I would recommend
Oh
watching
no.
for the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many better films that he
Yeah.
did. I think Kagemusha was maybe like a studio obligation for him.
Right, kind of. there's a whole backstory of that we can get into, but I don't feel like getting into it.
Yeah.
But who was it? Okay, have you seen Dodeska Den?
No.
Okay, that's a real divisive Kurosawa that I'm always curious people's opinion on it.
I have to see that one.
I personally like it a lot, but some people, it's their least favorite Kurosawa out of like all 30. So it's real divisive and weird and doesn't fully work, but it's kind of a weird outlier in his work. So I like it because it's a weird outlier.
Yeah. Well, then that's definitely a film I would watch then. Based on that, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's something different.
Yeah, he never went back to, well, he kind of did here and there, but it's real divisive. But,
see. Well, I've always been fascinated by the fact that he originally was tapped by the studios to do the Japanese version, the Japanese side of Tora, Tora, Tora.
Yeah.
And then they fired him because he went over budget. And it's like, they're saying there are only like 30 seconds of film that survived that Kurosawa did. So that aspect has always fascinated me. Like, why would they, you know, like, why would they tapped him and then they fired him? So I guess that's always been like a driving force for me to see his films, you know, beyond the fact that most of the films of his that I've seen involved Mifune, who I absolutely adore.
Yeah. Arguably his best to work with Mifune, which is a generic answer, but it's also the right answer, I think.
I like Shimura.
Yeah, you love your father, I know. But,
I don't know. So far, my favorite Kurosawa film, well, I mean, there's always, you can always fall back on The Seven Samurai, but I've always loved Throne of Blood. Because I am a Shakespeare fan. I have been a Shakespeare fan since middle school. And I read Macbeth when I was in school. I can't remember if it was like 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, something around there. But I read Macbeth in school. And then when I saw Throne of Blood, I was just completely enthralled. The way he, you know, the setting of it and how he filmed it. And I just feel it's a brilliant adaptation of Shakespeare.
Yeah, he turns it into like a horror movie, which is crazy.
Yes, exactly.
Like, I can't think of any other Shakespeare adaptation that goes that radically different.
No, me either. And I've seen like the Orson Welles versions of Shakespeare, and even what's his name, Kenneth Branagh. You know, like I've seen various adaptations of Shakespeare, but Throne of Blood still just grabs me, and it's like that was the way I think that Shakespeare would have loved it had he been able to see it.
Yeah, maybe. But don't want to keep you too long. So do you have other movies from 52/53 that you'd recommend?
Well, yes, of course. There is The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Yes. Well, you get a film with Harry has an effect, you have to watch it.
Oh, yeah.
Good or bad, you have to watch it.
Oh, I'm thinking of a different movie. There's some octopus giant monster American movie from that time.
I don't know about your strange fetish movies.
I saw it on TCM like randomly years ago, and I never learned the name of it. I've been wanting to see it again. I'm looking at images from Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and it looks kind of like Gojira a little bit. Like some of the shots Let's miss it.
I get where you're coming from on that. That's definitely. I think, well, yeah, I think they modeled it on that. But then there's also From Here to Eternity. I mean, Frank Sinatra.
That the movie he won an Oscar for?
Yes, he did actually. He won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for that film.
Yeah, that's a movie I've always heard of, but I have never seen.
You've never seen that film?
Me neither.
There's a lot of movies I
Really?
haven't seen.
Seriously? That's Burt Lancaster, Deborah Carr. That's the famous scene of Deborah Carr and Burt Lancaster on the beach.
Yeah, I've seen that scene before.
But you've never seen the entire film? Oh my goodness. That's a film you absolutely must see. That is definitely one worth seeing.
Yeah, I'm looking at pictures and I have seen images from this movie.
Well, From Here to Eternity, that takes place, that actually takes place in Hawaii. And then it's like the lead in to when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Oh, interesting.
But there's this whole backstory of, love and lust and all kinds of stuff going on. Because Deborah Carr is like married to somebody else and she's having an affair with Burt Lancaster, and it's just like this whole,
Wait a second, wait a second. It just kicked in. Deborah Carr, she was the nun in Black Narcissus.
Yes, she was.
Okay, I need to see this movie now.
You must. You absolutely must. She also, I believe Deborah Carr was the nanny in what the film that was based, oh my goodness, with the kids, the one that was based on the story by Henry James, The Innocents.
Oh, that's another movie I've heard a lot of but I've not seen. There's a
I
lot of American.
believe, let me check. I believe Deborah Carr was the nanny in The Innocents. And that's a great film. That's based on the story by Henry James. The only real Christmas, well, I like, I obviously, what is it, White Christmas, but I like Holiday Inn, and most people don't actually consider that a Christmas movie, but I do.
Well, to me, a Christmas movie means some significant part of it takes place around or during Christmas. I have a very loose guidelines for it.
I like The Bishop's Wife.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Oh.
And
Warm episode on your podcast, Joel.
Yep.
Cary Grant is fantastic in that film. And Elsa Lanchester of Bride of Frankenstein fame is in that film also.
Gee, if I remember correctly, I am drawing a blank right now. Do you have other 50, 50, 53, 50, 52? Because you mentioned a couple before we recorded.
Oh, Abbott and Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I mentioned that before we recorded.
Yeah.
They did an Abbott and Costello film.
Do you mention you say I'm did you mention one where they go to Mars?
Yes. Abbott and Costello. Yes, Abbott and Costello go to Mars.
I've heard of a lot of movies, but that is one I have never heard of. And
Yeah, that's one I have. I don't know if I've ever seen that film in its entirety. I think most people would probably be dumbstruck to hear having Costello go to Mars. What?
yeah, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, a lot of
But,
time on their hands.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Exactly. Oh, you know what else came out in that year? Calamity Jane with Doris Day.
Oh, yeah. And,
House of Wax is the one I was waiting for.
Yes,
yeah.
House of Wax.
With a young Charles Bronson, where he didn't look too leathery. That's just a little leathery.
Yeah, he was young then. Well, that was before
That was before Magnificent Seven, wasn't it? It must have been.
Yeah.
Yes.
Magnificent Seven is 60, I
Yeah,
think.
he doesn't look very leathery in that one.
He looks very leathery though in Once Upon a Time in the West.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, so what's my time? Okay. It's getting late over here. So, thank you for your time.
Thank you for including me.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, and do you have anything to plug? Any articles or stories or anything like that?
Nothing current. Just still writing reviews for Monster Librarian, so you can always check out a book review from, by me over there.
All right, and R.A.P. Cinema Knife Fight. It could
Yes,
return, but
I know. That's so sad.
yeah, LL basically, I posted that on Facebook, and LL said, like someone said, it don't be sad, it might come back, and LL responded, it's not gonna come back.
No,
That's.
he's been, he's working on his own stuff. He just doesn't have the time anymore, and I understand that,
I mean, he did it for like 15 years or something. Me
Yes,
and Mike,
Cinema
which
Knife
is
Fight was around
crazy.
for a long time,
Yeah.
even
But
before I got there.
yeah, I think we
Like I,
joined around the same time.
yeah, I well I start I think I wrote for Cinema Knife Fight for I would say around 3 years. I think the very first article I ever wrote for Cinema Knife Fight was the third Tetsuo film.
Oh.
The Bullet Man, Tetsuo the Bullet Man, because I got to go see it during one of the film festivals here in the city, and Tsukamoto was there
Oh, wow.
after the film and did like a Q&A, and that was the first thing I ever wrote for Cinema Knife Fight.
Yeah, I started summer, August of 2015, I think.
Good. You
14.
came in after I did.
Yeah, it was around that time, and it was a review of Sharknado 2 because no one else wanted to do it, and I said okay, and that's the last Sharknado movie I ever watched. And I hate that review so much. I'm glad it's gone.
Yeah, I can understand why.
Anyway, so Joel, any what's up with you?
Just the usual stuff. Please don't send me in outer space is a weekly science fiction and fantasy movie I do with my co-hosts Aaron and Sarah. I'm running late on all the stuff. Like we still haven't published that monitors episode yet, but we have recorded it. And that's the new hotness. Eventually, we're gonna get out our top five sci-fi and fantasy for a certain decade. I would say specifically what decade, but I chose an archaic time period, and that was stupid. But anyways, that's coming out too pretty soon. So,
Okay.
anyways,
And yeah,
that's in the usual
Christmas
spots.
episode coming up.
Yeah, we were just talking about that. I think we're gonna do an actual Scrooge movie because we haven't done that yet. And we just got to
Oh.
figure out which one we want to do. I'm thinking Muppets because that sounds like fun. And
Oh,
I
that has.
love that movie.
That movie's so good. And it has a crazy moment where like a snowman is dancing and his head falls off. And
Yep.
they react and they're like and they act horrified when they see it fall off, and then this movie just moves on. It's never commented on. I love that joke so much.
I love that version.
Yeah, so look forward to that kind of stuff.
Yeah. That snowman died. It's crazy.
I mean that snowman was a war criminal, you
Okay. Whatever you say. But wait, this will come out in late summer, so by this time wait, what's coming out? On my site it might be, I'm not sure. I have a whole bunch of things I'm gonna do had all the reviews coming up. But like I have a double feature of Fukasaku Yakuza cop movies coming up. By the time this comes out, the preview of Burst City will be out. This punk rock 2-hour music video, post-apocalyptic thing. It's crazy, science fictiony, and yeah, it's really something
Sounds
special.
interesting.
Yeah, it's I don't know how to explain it. It needs to be seen to be understood. And I think January, so shortly after this comes out, my second episode of Russophiles Unite will be out on Ivan's childhood, my favorite Tarkovsky movie,
Oh.
and my second favorite World War II movie. My first favorite is Closely Watched Trains, which is a Czech movie, so not Russian, so it doesn't count. But yeah, I think by that's coming in January-ish time, and in January, I think I'm going to record my third FlexWise Canada episode. This will continue the theme of doing African films. This will be on A Screaming Man from 2010 by my favorite living director, Mohamed Salah Haroun, which is a great tragic drama about life in modern day Chad. And yeah, look out for that stuff. And that's it. Next episode will be the final episode on Ikaru. So we're going out strong.
Bye.
Bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podient. Thank you for listening.